Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This incredibly grueling and interminable 2016 presidential campaign, which had its beginning in the dim long ago, approaches its cataclysmic pre-climax period these next few months following the party conventions. Soon, despite promises and the usual false collegial memories of campaigns past, the political implosion of fear, hate, and loathing will illuminate the final pre-election period all the way up to the ballot box. Back in the last millennium, I wrote a series of satires for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, that focused on controversial political personalities in which the stories played out at Astoria's make-believe nightclub, Top of the Astor. This seems a fertile year to replay a few of those lampoons. So why not start by seizing the prime moment of the first ever major party nomination for a woman president to pillory Hillary's husband in his last campaign for re-election to the same Oval Office, which was itself the last presidential campaign of the 20th century. Please accept my disclaimer that this is a product of my imagination, not intended to malign, but poke parody and perhaps a dose of grim ridicule, and represents no other opinion in the universal galactic order. I call it the transmutation of Billy Bob. So imagine yourself in a parallel Astoria that had the good sense to stave off demolition and convert the top floor of the J.J. Astor Hotel into a restaurant and night spot, the famous and notorious Top of the Astor. It is summer, 1966, and Astoria is having a regatta. Bill Clinton and Bob Dole met secretly in Astoria in a small private banquet room of the famous and always popular Top of the Astor. I discovered their meeting because I was waiting tables at that stage of my recovery from financial disaster, which was less a result of the shift of wealth from the many to the few, as it was a couple of unwise personal decisions that left me broke and underemployed for several months. That decision was a stubborn intent to continue publishing an impoverished newspaper dedicated to erasing the inequalities of wealth, gender, race, and politics, and rising print costs. "Guess who's breaking bread together?" I said to my friend Rio Rita, who was working behind the bar. "Let me guess. Oral and Hardly," she said. I looked at her sharply. "How did you know?" I was an impertinent and surly waiter, quite surprised to be employed at Astoria's most posh drinking and dining emporium, which is 8 stories above the city's downtown streets and commands a splendid view of the Columbia River and the ascending hills clustered with lovely old Carpenter Gothic houses and churches. From the top floor is visible the site of Fort Astor, the city's birthplace. My previous experience as a waiter was in a gag and barf place called Spike's Bisque and Burger, where the help greeted every customer with a snarling, "What the barnacles do you want?" My customers are rustic squires who made their money in fish and timber and whose artistic pretensions are quenched by endless community theater presentations of old Broadway musicals. You never knew when the tables filled with after-theater patrons would suddenly erupt into song, which I dreaded. Like almost everyone on Earth who has no clue as to what must be done to maintain a grasp upon this elusive world, and in reasonable fear of the few who think they know the answers, I collect information which sometimes I am able to synthesize and pass on through my esoteric little newspaper, a perennial cause of my subsistence below the poverty line, an ardently opinionated public radio program. So readers and listeners can sympathize with my reaction to seeing Clinton and Dole sitting at the same table, in the same room, in the same restaurant, in a small, out-of-the-way city in the northwest corner of the lower 48 as Astoria. Its only distinction that it is the oldest city in the American West. Their private banquet room was dominated by a window that overlooked the Columbia River, named for the great navigator who missed India by half a world, and known to history as the Great River of the West. Astoria's annual regatta was at full sail and throttle. Boats of various sizes, shapes, and purposes paraded along the waterfront, festooned with banners and flags, while a land parade marched past the city's skyscraper, named after John Jacob Astor, a vintage eight-story mass of white plaster that started as a popular hotel after a fire devastated Astoria's heart in 1922. It almost fell to the wrecking ball, or egregious implosion, except that a few visionaries realized a fancy first water restaurant and nightclub on the top floor would bring prosperity to the city after half a century of decline, because the fish were gone and the forests clear cut to stumps. This was represented by the publicly subsidized poverty apartments on the lower floors. The noise of bands, horns, and sirens rose in thermal waves through the open windows of the top of the Astor, drowning out much of the dialogue between the two candidates vying to be the last American president of the 20th century. I admired their calculated anonymity in a backwater northwest city at a moment when it was packed with locals and tourists who would never notice them in a crowd. My news hound curiosity and suspicion were piqued by the purpose of their clandestine parley. What I was able to hear of their intense, cryptic conversation gave me the heartsick realization that the incumbent and his political poltergeist were tearing up the Constitution. They were alone in the banquet room that was profitably developed for the use of lovers and intriguers who could afford the high price of privacy. But as I watered them and took their order, I was aware I had been critically inspected by several unusually alert diners at tables bunched near the room's entrance. I wondered if I had been quickly perved and spot-checked, or if the conspiring candidates accepted the rare possibility their waiter might be an assassin as an unavoidable risk. The first few times I approached their table, they hushed, but after a half a dozen trips with water, soup, slop, and bourbon, they continued jabbering as though I was simply mobile furniture, a prologue to a future dependency upon servile robots. Almost as mechanically, I converted my journalist brain into a recording device, locking each word into a dialectic cocoon, and worried if I had enough cerebral capacity to store Clinton's verbiage. I heard very little of the conversation because I spent most of the time en route between kitchen, bar, and table, but I was able to hear the last several minutes when they ignored my loitering around a serving cart in which I freighted desserts and lattes. Dole sat stiff and starchy. His face was pasty and looked like too many facelifts gone awry. Clinton smiled and stared at him with the expectant cheerfulness of a snake about to swallow a rabbit. They talked insistently. Dole crisp and spare, his voice a hard-edged whine, often accusatory and self-righteous. Clinton rambled in a folksy fog of alphabet soup that seemed to include in its broth references to most of the sciences, as well as religions, economics, and social peculiarities of most of the world's cultures. Dole's sights seemed clearer, but lacked the vision thing, as an equally eloquent George Bush Sr. called it. He seemed to be counting pebbles while Clinton built a shining mountain for humanity to ascend. I felt partial to Clinton. We share the same birth date of August 19th. The five-year difference made him the first U.S. president younger than me. I wrote a birthday letter his first year as president, comparing his presidency with the one-year term I was serving as a company union president. After three terms, the company impeached me. He wrote back, or one of his flappers, that he was pleased that our mutual natal day and softpawness, ovulated lefties, inspired our shared political correctness. But Clinton was a great disappointment. Slick Willie, friends as well as enemies called him. He's never inhaled, one of my friends said of him, disgusted that he failed to stand up for liberal policies he promised to implement, and because he steals the conservative thunder from its adherents, such as signing a stingy welfare law that impoverishes children and punishes single mothers. A few of his detractors and friends call him the Muhammad Ali of modern politics. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. He and Dole were described as creatures of Oz. Clinton said to have no spine, Dole no heart. Clinton loves to press flesh, claims he lives in the crown jewel of the nation's penal system, the White House, always under guard with every visitor strip searched, especially after two trespassers seemed inspired to terminate his presidency. He pressed Dole's flesh with his voice, intimate and charming, which disarmed Dole as much as it also did me. Dole either ignored me or did not register my presence, yet Clinton seemed to let me feel he was aware and pleased I was serving him. I was tempted to tell him we shared birthdays, and being natural-born lefties, but resisted the foolish thought. I had to remain low-key and generally unnoticed, an invisibility similar to black-clad Japanese no-puppeteers, if I wished to discover the real purpose of this meeting. I'm going to win, Bob, I heard Clinton say. The only real chance you've got of beating me is that crazy supply-sider Jack Kemp, but that's a long shot, Clinton smiled coyly. That little stroke of genius raised you a couple of points in the polls, but not enough to win, Bob, and you're stuck with him. If by some miracle you do beat me, he will make your life a living hell. You might just die to be rid of him, and guess who's president then, he asked facetiously. That prospect seriously worried Dole. He still smarted from Kemp's remark about his library burning down, his two books burned, one of which he hadn't finished coloring. Dole's retort was that Kemp, a former pro footballer, had played without his helmet, which was originally quipped about another Republican and former gridiron star who did become president, but not elected, Gerald Ford, who was also accused of not being able to walk and chew gum simultaneously, a slam against his left-handedness. A joke was that his first lady, Betty Ford, practiced birth control by giving him a stick of gum before bedtime. Everything is political, my friend the dish dog shouted at the cook, a large, genial redneck he loved to argue with, as I bumped into the kitchen with a tray of dirty dishes. The dish dog was a poet and an acute political philosopher. Encountering with him anywhere was generally unsettling as well as illuminating. Are we really so stupid as to seriously consider two rich white guys as the only suitable candidates for president in this whole polyglot country? He growled at me, slamming trays of dishes into an automatic dishwasher that immediately wreathed them in clouds of steam. We're governed by pious hypocrites who are mostly white troglodyte males in a country in which women are the majority and the great variety of other races vastly outnumber Anglos. Country club apartheid, he spat disgustedly. The dish dog's theory, which he expounded as often as anyone would listen, was that the white race is historically dead, and despite the virulent angst of skinheads and white supremacist militias, none will be left in the world in two centuries. Of course, he was so white he was almost pink, but he loved to say to his diminishing number of Caucasian acquaintances, I am extinct. You are extinct. You ought to think about becoming a Republican, he said drolly as I was about to kick my way out the door with a load of grub for the contenders. Because Dole or Kemp said Republicans won't tolerate despair in the cities anymore. If they win, you can join me in the line of good-hearted fellows trying to get hired as officers of the Joy Police. I was out again, back into the conversation, if only briefly and without contextual bridges. I could only guess, yet a pattern emerged. Clinton especially cajoled Dole to agree that the current two-party system was kaput, obsolete, and inefficient. Slick Willy stuff. I couldn't see his point. Where was he going? Why this secret meeting? Two political parties don't represent the people any more than Congress, the White House, or Wall Street, the dish dog said my next trip to the kitchen. He was steam-clouded from the dishwashing machine and seemed to look through me while he ranted. People talk about wanting a third party as if we have a two-party system. We don't. We've got one big party with two fat heads. Problem is, most people get disgusted and stop voting, especially the people most adversely affected, and that simply perpetuates the problems. The era of big government is over, Clinton said when I was back in the banquet room with his assorted junk food and Dole's rubber chicken. Everything is for sale to the private sector, except the Pentagon. Even welfare is going to be privatized. Poverty is profitable, he chuckled. The commies were right, the dish dog said, blurred in hot fog. International class war is replacing nationalism. This whole new world capitalist order we are designing is a direct schism between rich and poor. Those are the only political parties that count, the rich party and the poor party. The dish dog once told me that morality was a human response to an amoral world, in particular our own predatory nature. He divided humanity into predator and prey, and each, he said, was fanatic and ruthless. Morality's got nothing to do with God or religion, he said. It's a tool to protect us from ourselves. The paradox is that the moral position about anything is generally fatal in the short run, but absolutely necessary for long-time survival. It's real simple. What's moral helps most people. The greatest good for the greatest number sort of thing. What's immoral hurts us, which includes the greedy bastards grabbing all the money. Back in the banquet room, I heard Clinton say to Dole, while I busied about the serving cart, Bob, some of our mutual friends are getting tired of duplicating expenses. That's why they suggested we do lunch, he said, talking with full mouthfuls of cheeseburger. We gotta face reality, Bob. The Democratic and Republican parties are, for all political purposes, the same party, Clinton said, swallowing cheeseburger with bourbon as mouthwash. We share the same interests and world views when you cut through the hog spit. We share the same sponsors who really don't care which one of us is president. It'll still be business as usual, except one of us loses. Clinton leaned back in his chair and lit one of his famous cigars. Neither one of us has to lose, Bob, he said expansively, blowing smoke over Dole's head. The smartest thing for both of us to do is consolidate. Target the centers of our parties and let go the radical fringes. We don't want to go chasing after the minorities, ideologues, and nutcases. We got to put up with the women, but we can let the rest go. Let Perot and Nader have them. We have to be bold and realistic, Clinton said, biting lustily into a dripping piece of pizza. We can share the really big money without it being divided between separate campaigns. Bob Dole doesn't want the American people to think he will ever be a part of anything that destroys traditional values, Dole said. Cork the cod swallop, Clinton said affably, puffing on the cigar between pizza bites. You're here because you know you can't win. You want a deal, and you hope I asked you here to give you a good one. The most cherished American value is winning, Clinton drawled. Why should either of us risk losing when we can win together? Are you suggesting we betray our parties? Dole asked starchily. We will form a super party that can't be beat, Clinton said. But the only way this deal can work is that I remain president. Dole started to protest. But Clinton put his hand on his arm, the one without the pizza drool. Listen, Bob, Veep is the closest you're ever going to get to the White House. I'm offering you a chance that'll work for both of us and kick Kemp's butt out. What about Gore? Dole asked suspiciously. Clinton shrugged. Al will have to find his own way to the new age of Aquarius, he said languidly. I was appalled. Surely Dole would treat that most cynical and corrupt proposition with the contempt it deserved. Instead, his sour face broke into a childlike, almost beatific smile. He stared at Clinton with a look of bedazzled enchantment on his face and could not have expressed any better his delight and wonder, as if a door had been opened for him to enter an entirely new world of giddy new possibilities. I thrust myself at their table. "Are you completely insane?" I shouted at their surprised faces. I started hyperventilating in a flurry of explosive verbosity. "The right wing and the left wing fanatics will start a revolution against the government at the same time they will fight a civil war against each other. There will be a racial bloodbath that will dwarf the slaughter in Rwanda. You're creating catastrophe out of chaos. You're acting as cynical and corrupt as everybody expects and accuses you of. And you'll be the first the mob comes after. They'll have your guts for neckties." The door burst open. A number of armed diners, some with napkins tucked under their chins, packed the doorway and pointed a variety of automatic weapons at me. I stared at them, then glanced angrily at the two conspirators. Dole was startled and angry at my outburst, but not Slick Willie. He sat back with a greasy chicken thigh in his hand. "It's evolution," he said with a wide, friendly smile. "Natural selection of the political process. You might say we're building a bridge to the 21st century. At that very moment, the righteously fiery ghost of William Jennings Bryan took possession of my soul and tongue. I stood stiffly and glared at them imperiously as I heard myself say, in ringing basso, the final words of the second most famous American speech, which he thunderously orated a century ago in 1896, perhaps the last time a political party was truly populist. "You shall not press upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." I stared down at them like an angered god, snapped my head up with a snort of disgust, and shoved my cart out of the room and through the cluster of spooks and bodyguards. "Do you know what those two bastards are doing?" I shouted at the dish dog as I slammed open the kitchen door. "What two bastards?" he asked. "They're ripping apart the Constitution." "Who? Who do you think I'm talking about?" I said. "They're here. They're right here in downtown Astoria plotting a political coup that will destroy the country." "Am I supposed to guess at the identities of these mystery guests?" the dish dog asked. I told him everything, stunned at the audacity and enormous consequences of what I overheard. "The only way democracy can survive is by keeping a balance between conflicting factions and allow none of them to get such power as to be capable of suppressing or persecuting the rest," the dish dog said seriously. "That's what I told them," I said ingenuously. "But they don't give a damn. They're selling out the country for their own selfish and imperial ambitions." "It goes much deeper than that," the dish dog said a trifle condescendingly. "I suppose they realize they're really irrelevant, just political real estate for rent or lease. The fat cats getting rich on the great upward flow of money are on a roll and not about to quit. They divert the world's wealth to offshore bank accounts and, like old Romans, exploit the new world capitalist order that has arisen on the ruins of Soviet communism. They're not going to give up anything. Instead, they take everything from everybody else. They are the world's real rulers now. They have subdivided nations into corporate colonies, buying and selling public governments for private capital like Wall Street stocks. Their mega corporations are already acting toward each other as irresponsibly aggressive and avariciously jealous as nations used to do." I was dizzy. Clinton and Dole plotting to overthrow the two-party system and form a single rich party. Why not Pluto Publicraticanism as the new epical idiom? And the dish dog on a parallel course in his reasoning that the real division of parties is wealth, but radically diverging in what to do about it. "We have to organize the poor party," the dish dog said. "We've got to go after the millions who have always been left out. We'll have a real revolution just by getting them to vote. We could start a dozen parties, two dozen. Save democracy with a tsunami of democracy," he said wryly. I heard a noise like heavy marching feet on the fire escape outside. I looked out a window from the kitchen and saw a two-by-two file of Astoria clowns marching up the eight stories of the John Jacob Astor from the parade down on the street. I saw them take small automatic weapons from inside their harlequin costumes and hold them in military-style port arms as they climbed up the fire escape. They wore Ronald McDonald masks. armed bozos, I shouted a warning to the dish dog and the cook, who quickly ducked into a walk-in freezer just as the clowns broke through the fire exit door into the kitchen. I ran out into the bar, grabbed Rio Rita, and pulled her down to the floor. "Who do you think you are, Bob Packwood?" she cried as I flopped on top of her. Before I could answer, my brain was numbed by a blast of John Philip Sousa blaring from a truck with four huge speakers passing by in the parade on the street below. At that moment, a group of clowns punched open the kitchen door and started shooting at everybody in the restaurant, all of whom I realized were armed and returned fire instantly. I could not hear the gunfire over the ear-splitting music of Stars and Stripes Forever. After Sousa blasted past, the restaurant was quiet, like after a thunderstorm or the departure of a noisy friend. I cautiously poked my head above the bar. Bodies were strewn everywhere in the dining room and lounge, amid overturned tables and chairs. In some places, heaps of them, clowns and spooks sprawled and tangled with each other. Suddenly, the main door to the restaurant was pushed open, and the most dangerous man in America, Ralph Nader the Raider, stormed through and strode briskly over the corpses, followed by a crowd of other third-party candidates for the presidency. They stalked into the small banquet room and slammed the door shut. Just at that moment, the corpses that cluttered the floor began to flare and vanish. In zilch seconds, all that remained were oval char marks that polka-dotted the highly polished wood floor, which looked rather attractive and seemed to match the bullet holes that puckered the walls. "This changes everything," the dish dog said. He looked at me, stunned, yet not surprised. "We've crossed the millennium. The new world capitalist order is dead," he said without a trace of mourning. "Not only obsolete, but little more than an insignificant anthill, like Astoria compared to the sun." He looked at me with a mixed expression of hope and dread. "We are, as of this moment, new citizens of the universal galactic order, and we might seem to our celestial masters like chimps in a planetary zoo instead of as a civilized species." "I like the way they clean up after themselves," Rio Rita said, looking at the polka dot floor. I walked to the banquet room and pulled open the door. The room was empty, which I half expected. The table was set, undisturbed. An afternoon wind flapped the window curtains. I looked out the window. The parade had passed, and motor vehicles were once more crowding the street. A temporary reviewing stand erected near the John Jacob Astor's fire escape, earlier packed with local kahunas, was empty. A large ship steamed up river past the downtown riverfront, and a gaggle of other ships parked at anchor, awaiting berths in the inland cities. Half a dozen disc-shaped clouds emerged from a saffron haze like UFOs in the afternoon sky, zooming in on Astoria from over the ocean and across the mountains on the opposite shore of the wide Columbia River. Early humans, claimed by Carl Jung no less, to have looked for saucer shapes in the sky to save them from disruption and disaster. I watched the frisbee clouds spinning in their own murk and wished I could whirl through the sky in them, above and away from chaos and corruption. I often felt that I was waiting for a spaceship to take me away. After what seemed a dream time, I walked out into the main restaurant. A few diners sat at tables and a couple of early evening drinkers were at the bar. I looked at the walls and floor. No bullet holes or polka dot scorches. I stared at Rio Rita as if I had not seen her before. She motioned me over to the bar. "Spacing out again?" she asked. She nodded toward the patrons. "Earth requires your presence for a while," she said. "Everything is political," the dish dog shouted at the cook. "That slop you're burning black is political. The gluttons out there who gobble it up and bitch about indigestion are political. And the goddamn boss screaming he's going to fire you unless you learn to cook is political." "All politics are local," the dish dog said to me as I stuck food orders to a rack next to the grill. "You should write political satire," he said. "You could change half the world with political satire." "I don't want to change the world," I said, as I watched him disappear in a steaming cloud. "I just want to know what the hell is going on." "The only real political question is who's getting screwed and who's doing the screwing," I heard his muffled voice through the steam cloud. And this has been Michael McCusker.